You're listening to Audio Culture on 95BFM.
Thanks to Audio Culture, Iwi Waiata, the noisy library of New Zealand music. Go to audioculture.co.nz.
A very, very special guest this evening is the one and only Murray Kamik, a local legend, just all round amazing music character, a fixture on the scene, and of course here on the BFM dial on a Friday afternoon. Welcome to the BFM studio, Murray, on the interrogation side of the desk this
evening.
Yeah,
I'm on the wrong side. I'm sitting down.
Now, this evening we are talking Rip It Up. Obviously, I guess the most important New Zealand music publication in history.
I'm not really sure about that, but there have been a few others of importance, Playdate and there's a few others, Groove and whatever. But it at one point, and when we started in 1977, it was one of almost the only way of getting up to date music info, because the NME and the local record bookshop was 3 months old.
Yes.
So that's when Rip It Up, we got the Mere Mail and we stole their news, not their views, but their news. Mm-hmm. and we got to write our own stories in terms of features and reviews.
So was it a mix at the time, was it a mix of local and international stories?
Like, it was very important to have bands like Spit Ends, because they were just the ultimate in every way. But we were also into Hello Sailor, and we got into the Dudes and Citizen Band as they developed, and they were more sort of in the pub band area. But
was it mostly a pub band scene at the time?
Well, Spit Ends were very different, because they just did His Majesty's Theatre, and when they toured, they just did places like town halls and stuff, which was quite adventurous, and they just didn't want to be competing with the sales of booze. They were a bit arty, I guess, at the time. But that commitment to creativity and writing their own songs, that inspired everybody else. I don't think you get a Dave Dobbin writing his songs unless you had the Finns writing their songs first.
It's quite an interesting stance to take at the time with booze and alcohol, because it's entrenched into New Zealand culture, and I can imagine at the time it was even heavier drinking culture than it is today.
Yeah, I guess so. The only difference was that when pubs closed at 10 or 11, particularly the 10 o'clock closing era, the cross-section of crowd was quite significant for, say, a band like Hello Sailor, and you really got the vibe that, guys and girls were going to go home and actually play netball or rugby the next day,
Yes.
what I mean?
Yep.
And when the late licenses happened and bands were going on at 11 and 12, they actually had a tougher time getting the crowd.
With some perspective, with having some skin in the game over such a long duration, do you think it was better having shows start earlier than later, as is now?
The earlier shows were better, but you've just got an economic situation that has existed for 20 or 30 years almost, where people can't necessarily
finish work.
They can't afford the price of beer at a bar, so they preload. And that was occurring when I was working with bands on Wildside, was that you had to come on at 1 a.m. Which is not really conducive to the bulk of the population. But if your bands are coming on at 1 a.m, which was happening at the Wellington bars when I'd go down there, people would just do all their drinking at home from a wholesaler. And that's part of the whole dysfunction of the economy, housing prices and everything, which has been going on for 20, 30 years.
Yes. So around that time, was that sort of the Head Like a Hole and She Had in Wellington, morning shows?
Yeah, I think it was a little later when I was working with bands like Accelerants and Paceloads, and sometimes I'd drive down from Auckland and then get told, the band comes on at 1 a.m. And one time I had Graham Brazier with me, because we were going on Radio New Zealand the next morning, Kim Hill, you know, and, you know, sort of a bit of a...
Yes.
Trying to get there on time and see a band at one in the morning, you know.
Yeah. I did a lot of my sort of heavy going out was around the time Pace Loads were coming up to Auckland and playing. They were good friends and played lots of good shows all around Auckland. Really, really good live band. Obviously, Nado, who was the bass player in Pace Load, went on to do Beast Wars.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he had great success there. But it, by that stage, it was hard getting an audience in, so, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
But bands like Hello Sailor, when they started, they were having to do cover versions too. So so that's where a lot of people heard songs like The Passenger, which is now termed classic rock, by Iggy Pop. They'd hear it done by The Dude, say, or they'd hear Hello Sailor doing Velvet Underground, Waiting for the Man, or that sort of stuff. You would actually hear it through the pub bands.
I mean, that sounds exciting to me, you know. It'd be wonderful to go out and see a band do a ripping cover of a classic.
Yeah, well, they weren't classics then, though. They were new songs, see, because they had those albums. They got them import from LA from someone who was at uni there. Phil Mills, in fact. Phil Mills? Is that the younger guy? Yeah. And so they were, they, you know, the cover versions were quite creative sometimes.
I mean, how did you, I know you sort of touched on it at the start where Rip It Up might have got some of its inspiration from, but where were you getting the international content from? How, what was the best way to get a story?
We were just, well, the stories, we would do our own interviews when people toured or do phone interviews, or sometimes people did promo tours, like Iggy Pop did one in 79, and Debbie Harry did one in November 77 when we didn't even know who she was, you know.
They just came down here and talked to the press and flew to Australia.
Yeah. It was, at the time, Blondie did have a hit in Australia, so they were going to tour there a little later, but they just came through New Zealand to see if they could create a bit of interest, you know.
Was it exciting meeting, did you get to meet Iggy Pop in 79?
Yeah. We just went to the old White Heron Hotel, which doesn't exist anymore. And when we arrived, he was still in his pajamas, so I sneaked a photo sort of from the hip. And he heard the camera, you know, cameras making noise. And he just looked at me and said, no photos in my pajamas.
Yes. Have you still got that photo?
Yeah. It's not very in sharp, you know, but he is... He's actually, I don't know, he seems to have turned to me before, because I've caught him turning towards me, but he probably just worked out what I was going to do. But
anyway. Oh, what was he like to chat to at the time?
Oh, great. He was just, I wasn't the interviewer, I was just the photographer, but he was super friendly and he'd got over his addiction problems, and I think he is enjoying being in New Zealand, getting the record company to do his laundry for him. And
yeah, totally.
Here's my guitar too. Can you get it fixed? So,
do you have some absolute favourites of people that you've either photographed or got to meet with, you know, thanks to Rip It Up?
Oh, probably Bob Marley, just because he's so special. But a lot of sometimes people surprise you in the sense that We did a lot of phoners, and sometimes you'd say you'd be dreading talking to Pat Benatar, and then she's a really lovely person, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And just really cool to talk to. Or I think I did Lita Ford, who was coming out here on tour, but in a phone interview, I think she's... And her last question to me was, what should I wear? You know, like she's talking about the seasons, and no one's ever asked me what they should wear.
Yes. It's incredible when you get someone on a good day. I love that, you know, they come in, and or you have a conversation with someone and it's like, oh, this person, you know, they're a bit of all right, and you strike up a bit of rapport. It's a wonderful feeling when you can really sort of hit it off with an artist.
Yeah, and some of them just go, you know, to completely crap out. Like one of my worst interviews was with Luther Vandross, and I'm a big fan, but I just couldn't relate to him. It was later in his career where I don't know what he wanted to talk about, but he certainly didn't want to talk to me.
Yeah. Now, Murray, we may as well play a couple of songs. You're in here. We're, of course, talking Rip It Up, turning 45 years old. this month.
And also the key thing is that you can actually look at these early issues on Papers Past. So you can just Google Rip It Up Papers Past or whatever, and you can then they just give you a big list. You can look at issue one, issue two, right up to issue 100, really. So,
and there's an amazing piece up on audioculture.co.nz with plenty of shots of old BFM alumni. I'm sure loads of familiar faces to regular BFM listeners out there.
Mm. We had a few, you know, one of our greatest writers was Russell Brown, who did great work on air too.
He actually came in a couple of weeks ago and talked about a story that he wrote on Straightjacket Fits when they were on tour through Europe. He caught them. He went and saw a show in Berlin. Does that ring any bells for you? Apparently, like, made the trek from London to Berlin to see them play, and wrote a piece.
I don't actually recall that, but he has mentioned that to me. But he did a fantastic Chills story in Europe, too, you know. So he did quite a bit of, you know, he did some great stuff when he was in London too.
Mm-hmm. Should we play a song? You have given us a couple to start off with, and I reckon it's obviously your choice. You're here, Murray.
It's brief, but Little Richard's Rip It Up. It's the name of the magazine. That's where we got it from. And it's about being a fool with your money, not trying to save, which sort of sums me up.
All those records you bring in on a Friday. They're basically new records every week, guys.
No.
Yeah, they are. Is that going to play? Come on, computer. Wake up. We're getting there.
I know the chorus, but...
Just waiting for this piece of technology to wake up, Murray.
Technology doesn't like me.
It should go in a second. We'll just pad it out, Murray.
Oh, well. Yeah, well, when I was in LA, a friend insisted I had to move about sort of 5 metres away for her to be able to make Uber work.
Mm-hmm. Everything else seems to be going well. Let's press play again.
Well, it's time to go. And I just got paid. Fool about my money, don't try to save. My heart say go, go. Have a time, cause it's Saturday night. Now I'm feeling fine, I'm on a rocket up.
Little Richard, Rip It Up. Murray Kamik from Rip It Up here, the BFM studio. We're talking about Audio Culture's piece on Rip It Up, as mentioned, turning 45 years old this month. Now, off air, Murray, we're just having a quick chat about music journalists' enthusiasm for particular bands and how that might translate to the wider world.
Yeah, sometimes music journalists often like stuff that doesn't sell, you know. And there was an era where artists Rip It Up liked, you could see their videos on radio with pictures, but student radio was in its infancy at that time, mm-hmm. you know, and I can recall doing advertisements and Rip It Up for the stations throughout the country, and, you know, some would be on, you know, from 4 p.m. and, you know, different stations were on at different times, mm-hmm. and often, I don't know if it was focused around holiday times or orientations. I think orientations was when there was more stations around the country than other times, but it was interest. Once those stations existed, well, acts could be in Rip It Up on BFM and Radio with Pictures if there was such an equivalent, mm-hmm. At one point, we were really enthusiastic about the band magazine, and all our writers liked it, and all our friends liked it. And someone wanted to suggested, you know, should I put them in the Auckland Town Hall? And I said, yeah, no, that'd be good. And they put an ad in Rip It Up and sold almost nil tickets. And then they came about a year later and did Power Station. But when I've done my exhibitions, I've never put Howard Devoto or Magazine in the exhibitions, because almost everybody's forgotten about them in a way. But they did have a few really good tracks, and you do have to remember that as a journalist, music journalist perspective, you might not reflect what the general public necessarily likes.
Nice. Shall we hear Magazine?
Yeah.
What song are we going for?
Shot by Both Sides, or From
Yes.
Both Sides?
Yes, Shot by Both Sides. Played in Empty Town Hall.
Oh, well, no, they didn't. No, they cancelled the show.
Oh,
no,
did they?
No one bought the tickets, yeah. So, no, they came back about a year later and did Power Station. Yeah.
Okay.
And they did all right at the Power Station. They did a couple of nights, I think.
Oh, They probably could have played the Town Hall then.
No way. No, that's too big a place.
All right, let's hear it.
Just what's real. What I've given to understand is exactly what I steal. I went my way into the heart of the crowd. Went my way into the heart of the crowd. I was shocked to find what was allowed. I didn't lose my soul in the crowd. Shots, battle signs.
Off air, I asked Murray if he kept copies of each individual magazine, each rip it up, and you seem to have a copy of most of them.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I was trying to keep more than one or two copies, but some of them we were selling as back issues, so we ran out. And I've kept most of them.
Do you have a favourite issue?
Oh, no.
No?
Not really, no. I actually think the time between 1994 and 1998, when we were owned by the Liberty Group, who also own National Business Review, I think those were very good years. Despite the fact we were owned by a big company, we had a good level of staffing, and it was the grunge era, you know, 1994 to 1998 was just cool time in terms of the grunge and emo, I guess, was coming in, and hip-hop was, I guess, ruling to some extent too at that time. And the New Zealand scene was quite fun. I was working with She Had and Head Like a Hole and stuff, and other groups were doing very well, Mutton Bird, Super Groove. That was a good time.
And I guess looping back in, all the student radio stations are probably full power and full time by that stage.
If you had a band like Pumpkinhead, you may not, you wouldn't even think of supplying them to commercial radio. It would just be student radio only. And the first two She Had albums, we didn't, at some point I think we supplied one of the tracks off Killjoy to rock radio to try and get it on at night times, but up until their third album, where we were targeting Radio Hauraki and the commercial stations, you just didn't even think about even telling them you've got a band called She Had, because it was so irrelevant to commercial radio.
Yeah. And also, in that same little off-air break, you were saying you sort of ruined the day that you reused all the tapes for...
Well, we interviewed all these amazing people, often on the phone interviews, you know, from Robert Smith of The Cure, Simple Minds, Clash, Elvis Costello, etc., and we never kept any of the tapes. Obviously, we also, it's important that we talk to Hello Sailor, etc., and Split Ends, and we never kept those tapes either. So it's all really rather stupid.
Are there any sort of little gold nuggets anywhere that some people did keep?
Well, I would have thought that the journalists or writers who were doing them from another city, like Dunedin, I would hope George Kay might have kept audio of his interviews, but I must ring him and ask.
Yeah.
But the way George Kay was one of our best interviewers, and he got good interviews by starting talking about soccer first, off air.
Yes.
Well, an equivalent to off air is just prior to starting your interview as a print journalist. And he talked about soccer first to sort of get on a wavelength with the English musicians that he largely covered.
Yes. It is an important sort of craft, you know, like being able to get people warmed up and ready to chat, right?
Yeah. Well, one of the things is, you know, just to know something about, you know, like some people, like someone like Debbie Harry, warmed to our writer because Jeremy Templer did that 1977 interview, and he knew who she was a good start.
Yeah.
And he knew the New York scene, and she's got out punk magazines like Slash, I think it was called, and gave him a copy, and I'm sitting there taking the photos thinking, oh, I want that magazine.
Yeah.
Why didn't she give it to the photographer? Well, she wasn't talking to me anyway.
Yeah. Nice. Hey, Murray, thank you very much for coming in this evening. Just to reiterate one more time, we're talking about the Rip It Up article, which is up on audioculture.co.nz. There's a bunch of stuff. I mean, you've obviously were editor at large of Audio Culture for a...
Yeah. There's a cover story where I talk about each individual cover, I think, with just the New Zealand acts, though, from the first 100. And that was done to celebrate the fact Rip It Up is on Papers Pass, so you can actually read the content, and even the advertisements are all there too, I think.
Nice one. Now, should we go out on one more song?
Yeah, I was suggested Herbs because I DJ a little bit, and I find the audio quality on Herb's recordings to be really A1. Back in the day, I think I thought Mandrill was the A1 studio or Harlequin, but the test of time has revealed that Mascot Studios did fabulous, amazing work with Herb's, with I think Phil Yule on engineering and production sometimes, and Billy Christian also as the producer sometimes.
So. Where was this particular studio?
Oh, Mascot was in, I think it might have been Charlotte Avenue or something off New North Road, just where there's quite a lot of apartments built now. I think it was Charlotte Street or Avenue or something. But it was a studio that was built up bit by bit, and eventually they were doing really good stuff.
Nice one. All right, Murray, thank you very much. Cool. We'll hear you on Friday afternoon, no doubt.
Yeah. Should be there.
And replayed on Sunday morning. I seem to always catch that in the car after the kid show.
Good one.
Thank you very much, Murray. Yep. And head to Audio Culture, everybody.
See y'all. Long ago,
That was
Audio Culture on 95 BFM.
Thanks to Audio Culture, Iwi Waiata, the Noisy Library of New Zealand Music. Go to audioculture.co.nz. It's just fascination.